Okay, thanks. So in light of that, these spaces that I have been writing down that are familiar to everybody, the O of K, 16 plus K, mod O of K cross O, 16 K plus K, modulo the lattice, that only describes bundles whose holonomies can be simultaneously conjugated into a torus, and it leaves out a number of components. These other components, I guess, will they admit similar descriptions? There's a subtorus of the torus for each of these other components?
I think you want to think of them in terms of unmissable bundles related to smaller groups.
Okay.
So, for example, in EA, you might get an unmissable E6 mod G2
right.
bundle.
Right. I suspect we're going to hear about this next week. Sure. I mean, I think it's CHL. Yeah. I think it's related to Witten's most recent paper, and probably forthcoming paper. It sounds like. So we may hear about this next week. Yeah. Okay, so I just have a few more things to say about 16 supercharges. The first is that I had some brief description in the first lecture about the type 1 prime theory formulated on S1 mod Z2 cross M1-8. So that's a nine-dimensional theory, in which we had these orientifolds at the ends, and then we had to put in 16 eight brains. To get a consistent theory. And the phenomenon that we were discovering in S theory of the seven brains coming together giving SUN enhanced gate symmetry, or seven brains going to special kinds of points, which I said had something to do with an orientifold plane, giving SO type symmetry, 2n plus 8 in that case, already appears here up in nine dimensions. So I probably should have pointed that out earlier, that you can move some of these eight brains together, getting the usual gate symmetry enhancement by the open strings that connect pairs of brains becoming massless, or you can move groups of brains over onto one or the other of the orientifold planes and get the symmetry enhancement to here. And you can also find configurations in this theory which will reproduce as well some of these other things on the Kodaira list. And I think I'll have occasion to come back to that tomorrow when I discuss some features of five-dimensional theories from this point of view. So I just wanted to make that remark because I had forgotten to make it earlier. The second thing I want to remark, it's not just about the 16 supercharge theories, is a major type of string duality that I haven't really mentioned as yet, except for one brief comment about it this morning, and that is mirror symmetry. So mirror symmetry relates the string theories compactified on certain pairs of Calabi-Yau manifolds with all the data being put into correspondence in some form. It can be thought of at the level of conformal field theory. So at the level of conformal field theory, it's an equivalence between the conformal field theories on certain pairs of Calabi-Yau manifolds. Which reverses the sign of some particular quantum number, some conserved charge. I don't want to take a lot of time to discuss mirror symmetry in detail. I did want to mention that in string theory, particularly the type 2A and 2B string theories, mirror symmetry is very relevant, And what happens is that if you have a mirror pair, X and X prime, the 2A theory on X is equivalent to the 2B theory on X prime if the complex dimension of X is odd, and it's equivalent to the 2A theory, excuse me, on X prime if the complex dimension of X is even. So examples of this include X is a real two torus, thought of as a complex curve, or a Calabi-Yau threefold. And examples here include X is a K3 surface and a Calabi-Yau fourfold. Pardon me. Yeah, a Calabi-Yau fourfold. So the relevance to the current, to the present discussion with 16 supercharges is that if we take the 2A theory compactified on a K3 surface, we can expect to find mirror symmetry transformations which relate, well, the K3 surface to itself, but what that really means is that there's typically a change in the data, in the geometric data, when you move from one of these points to the other point. And similarly, and I'll have occasion to use this in a few minutes, when we talk about Calabi-Yau threefolds, you'll see a relationship between the 2A theory on one threefold and the 2B theory on a mirror partner when a mirror partner exists. So mirror symmetry shows up right away when we push the analysis of 16 supercharged theories from the 2A perspective down a few more dimensions. So in dimension 5 plus 1, if we study the 2A theory on K3 cross M15, then what are the ingredients? Well, the ingredients are that you needed the metric, which we understand has to do with this 0319 mod 03 cross 019. You needed the 2 form, the harmonic 2 form, so that was a wedge 2 of R319. This metric, excuse me, also needs the volume here as a separate factor. And so this is, of course, modded out by some parabolic subgroup and has a parabolic subgroup of something, has a description in terms of 0420, mod 04 cross 020. And I also forgot the R plus, which is the string coupling, the doubleton. So I still keep a copy of R plus there. This is the B field. And it's not wedge 2. It's just R319. It's H2. Yeah. So we have a similar situation of an integral parabolic subgroup of this thing being the natural geometric equivalences among these data. Again, I have to leave out the set where there's enhanced gauge symmetry, but we know how to put it back in because of the enhanced gauge symmetry. And then PZ is extended to O of lambda 420 by the mirror symmetry equivalences. So mirror symmetry for K3 surfaces tells us that there will be unexpected equivalences among certain points in this space. And this is the geometric version, and you need mirror symmetry to go to O lambda 420. You can go down further, and I guess the additional symmetry that you need in discussing it in 4 plus 1 dimensions can be interpreted as coming from the 2B compactification on K3, if you like. Right. No, not anymore, right? Why 2A, 2B? Actually, this statement is older than that, and it has to do with looking at how the Ramon-Ramon fields are described in terms of this change of the conformal field theory. Yeah. Yeah, I'm sorry. There is an exchange between sort of vertical and horizontal cohomology even for the fourfold, right? Yeah, that's right. H3-1. That's correct. Pardon? Yeah, a T-duality. I mean, it's a little strange, right? Because 2a on T2 and 2b on T2 are the same with a parameter change also by this T2L. So I guess what I'm saying is it sort of naturally maps it to the opposite one. And if that happens to be the same as the other one by a T-duality, which is a separate question, then that's just... I guess it's a little confusing. Okay, so I think that's all I really want to say about 16 supercharge theories. We could push on down, but we're going to continue to get spaces of this kind, as you would expect. From the string-string duality, and that string-string duality should continue down as far as we like to go. So, finally, I come to the series with 8 supercharges. So, from the classification that Dan has reviewed for us, the maximum dimension that we can ever expect to find theories with 8 supercharges in is dimension 6. And just to get started, I'll have a few things to say about dimensions 6, 5, 4, and 3. So if I start from the heterotic perspective, well, what I'm wanting to do is break half of the supersymmetry on a heterotic compactification. So I should be looking for heterotic compactifications on a K3 or a K3 cross a single circle or a K3 cross a 2 torus or a K3 cross a 3 torus if I wanted to find direct 8 supercharged theories by looking at the heterotic strings. On the other hand, I can try the M or 2A. Well, let me just say 2A. Let me say M. I can try an M theory model. And for an M theory model, since we're starting with 32 supercharges, we need to break down to a quarter of the original supersymmetry. And a Calabi-Yau threefold will do that. But this is the first place where a Calabi-Yau threefold model can directly occur. Then here I could think of this as M on the Calabi-Yau cross S1, or more simply 2A on the Calabi-Yau, and then pushing further down, so let me just call these M or 2A, pushing further down, I can think of this as 2A on the Calabi-Yau cross S1, which is to be identified, if you like, with 2B on the Calabi-Yau cross S1 prime using the T-duality. You can think of this as being either 2A or 2B. So this is the class of things that we'd like to study. And of course, here we'll have some kind of F-theory models occurring as natural limits of the Calabi-Yau models, as in the case of the K3 surface, where what we're hoping is that when you have an elliptic fibration on a Calabi-Yau manifold, which, unlike the case of K3 surfaces, where just by moving within the family of all K3 surfaces, I could get to a K3 that had an elliptic fibration, it's actually a somewhat unusual property of a Calabi-Yau threefold to have even anywhere in the particular component of its moduli space that you're looking at to have an elliptic fibration. That's a little bit unusual. But when you do have one, you should be able to follow the path in the Kähler moduli space, which takes the elliptic fiber to have zero area and see a decompactification to an F-theory model in six dimensions in that way. So it will also be useful for producing certain F-theory models. And of course, well, you could imagine playing other tricks and inserting brains in other kinds of models and breaking some of their supersymmetry. So maybe, you know, some kind of 2A on K3 with some brains inserted or something like that. I don't really know any useful models like that offhand. So we've finally gotten down to an amount of supersymmetry which is much less constraining in terms of the structure of the moduli space. So the structure of the parameter space well, there are vector multiplets, massless vector multiplets. So I should say the scalars in these massless vector multiplets describe some of the parameters. And then you have the scalars in the massless hypermultiplets. Dan hasn't been through the classification of multiplets here, but there are two basic kinds of multiplets in a gauge theory in this particular amount of supersymmetry. And then there's these coupled to the gravity multiplet. So in a supergravity theory, we also have a gravity multiplet which has some scalars. And the structure of the hypermultiplets with gravity decoupled is that of a hyper-Kähler manifold. Of a hyper-Kähler manifold. And the structure, including the gravity multiplet, is of a quaternion Kähler manifold, so-called. So this has a holonomy classification, holonomy characterization. The holonomy here is contained in SPN, and here the holonomy is contained in, maybe I should say equal to, SPN dot SP1. Here there is also some kind of constraint on the geometry of the parameter space. And it's summarized by what's known as special geometry. And exactly which version of special geometry we get depends on which dimension theory we're working with, because the behavior of the hypermultiplets is dimension independent. This is the same in all the dimensions I'm discussing. But the number of scalars and their structure in terms of special geometry depends on the dimension. And I should also mention, and Dan did allude to this, that in 6D there is also a tensor multiplet. And that's something that's pretty mysterious in general. But these methods, particularly the F-theory models, have produced interesting ways of constructing models with lots of tensor multiplets, even though good Lagrangians for models with multiple tensor multiplets are not known. So that's kind of the abstract structure of parameter space, which you get by doing the supersymmetry analysis, and which in the previous cases has been so constrained as to have led us to learn that the parameter space was a locally symmetric variety. But in this case, that's not true. In this case, we have a certain amount of flexibility in the structure of the parameter space. But fortunately, the parameter space will be dictated by the geometry of the compactifying manifold, which is now more rich than it was in the previous case. So K3 surfaces have a beautiful geometry, but after all, there's only one kind, and we know everything we need to know about the parameter space of the space of metrics on it, and so on. Collodial manifolds now provide a much more varied cast of characters to play a role in the study of these parameter spaces here. So let's look at what these moduli spaces will have as their basic structure for M-theory on Calabi-Yau manifolds, Calabi-Yau threefolds in particular. The basic ingredients, as I've been stressing, are a Ricci flat metric a harmonic three-form, which is definitely a real part of the story this time, and I can also look at a harmonic six-form in this particular case. This harmonic six-form essentially is the coming from the dual field, dual of the three-form field. It's the thing to which the five-brain couples. And since I have now an ambient space of dimension 6, that plays a role in this story. So what do we know about Ricci flat metrics on Calabi-Yau threefolds? Well, there's Yau's theorem, Yau's proof of Calabi's conjecture. Right, that's right. So I'm really going to analyze this purely from the view of 11-dimensional supergravity, which is supposed to be the low-energy approximation, and it should be a reasonable approximation if the volume of the Calabi-Yau is big. It's the supersymmetry and supergravity algebras which really determine that. In that case, in these previous cases, everything was so constrained by supergravity that it was only the issue of completeness, the issue of describing the physics at points that appeared to be missing, and the issue of discrete group that you needed to identify with. But now when we get down to eight or fewer supercharges, the constraints are much less, and so you have to make a description based on geometry, but then you only expect that to be the correct description. You expect that to be just a kind of first-order approximation to the correct description, and then you need to learn about quantum effects, which would modify that in some way or another. So I'm literally writing down the parameter space of the classical supergravity. Absolutely. Well, I'm taking this topological manifold, and I want a Ricci flat metric on it, which is compatible with some complex structure, certainly. But I want Ricci flat Kähler metrics, I should say. Yes, but I just momentarily worried about some whole other component of Ricci flat metrics having nothing to do with Kähler structures. And I'd just rather not think about that. So Yau's proof of Calabi's conjecture implies that the data of a Ricci flat metric, so Ricci flat metric, Ricci flat metric, set of Ricci flat metrics, is essentially the same thing as a set of complex structures together with Kähler classes. Except that there's an issue of complex conjugation. So there's some Z mod 2. I guess I'm assuming that I'm discussing cases where the holonomy is actually equal to SU3 rather than some slightly degenerate case of a product of a K3 and a torus or something like that. And then there's some issue that complex conjugation does not change the Ricci flat metric, although it does change the complex structure in Kähler class. So, modulo that. Pardon? They're orientable. Why should I orient it? Well, that's true. Yeah, maybe with the harmonic six form. Maybe you're right. So maybe I don't have to worry about that. But if I just look at the metric, I don't think I've chosen an orientation. That's true. And also, I should point out, this is mod H6 XZ as before. So I don't really get a sign on that. Yeah. So I can describe, anyway, after this Z2 cover, I can describe the Ricci flat metrics by describing a complex structure in a Kähler class. Now, the way that this geometric data translates into the scalars in multiplets with respect to the supergravity, the supersymmetry algebra, goes like this. Goes like this. So the set of Kähler, set of Ricci flat metrics of norm 1, of volume 1, correspond to the vector multiplets. So I can represent that as the projectivization of the Kähler cone of the manifold. So any Kähler class can be scaled by a real number and produce another Kähler class. So if I projectivize that cone of things, I get some kind of object which represents, say, the volume 1, can be represented by the volume 1 Ricci flat metrics. And then the volume of X gets paired with the harmonic 6 form to give this scalars in the gravity multiplet. And I guess I guess I also have to say, and part of the H3X R mod H3XZ, it's a little hard to disentangle everything there. And the complex structure plus the rest of H3X R mod H3XZ together form the hypermultiplet moduli. We're in 5 space-time dimensions. Pardon? Looks better in the sense that this real space gets complexified. I mean, the question about whether it looks better or not is a little bit a matter of taste, right? So algebraic geometers wouldn't have included the Kähler moduli, period, right? I mean, this is not something that we would have treated as a separate degree of freedom. Now, whether you complexify it or not, it's still not included in the usual discussion in algebra, traditional discussion in algebraic geometry. This guy, well, so this has a natural structure of the, once you've chosen a complex structure, this can be given a structure of the so-called intermediate Jacobian. And when you do that, you get a family of tori, complex tori, varying over the family of complex structures, and the total space of that family, when you've included this additional complex scalar, which is this volume plus harmonic 6 form, should have this structure of a quaternionic Kähler manifold. Right? And pieces of it that are just describable independent of gravity with hypermultiplets should have structure of hyper-Kähler manifolds.
So do you have a complex structure on that?
This has a complex. If I fix a complex structure on the manifold, then there's the Griffith intermediate Jacobian complex structure here that I get for free.
Okay.
I
mean, did you use that?
Well, the total space of this family is has a complex symplectic structure,
yeah.
And which what's the current status of all this? You know this a little better than I do. Do we know that there exists in the local case, do we know that there exists this quaternionic Kähler metric or not? I'm looking at Dan because he wrote a paper about this. In the rigid case, we know that there's a decent metric, right? H, well, it doesn't matter too much. It's H3O plus H21. That's the one that I would use.
Okay. The one that
right.
varies.
That varies holomorphically. Right. Right. It's not in a billion variety. It's not in a billion variety because that's right. The other one is in a billion variety but doesn't vary holomorphically. And I think the Griffiths intermediate Jacobian is the better one to use for these purposes. Dinaghi and Markman showed that there's this structure of there's a complex symplectic structure, which is what you would expect to find if it were a hyper-Kähler manifold. It's not supposed to be a hyper-Kähler manifold except for subsets of the hypermultiples which decouple from gravity, but there must be some modification of that structure which is related to the quaternionic Kähler manifold. Pardon? It's in Dan's wonderful terminology, a pseudo hyper-Kähler manifold. Right.
Yeah, because of that sign problem.
Right. Right. So you'd rather use the Vey Jacobian and not have holomorphic variation, but have a definite metric. Is that what you would rather do?
Because you have to do a sigma model on
that. Oh, we should talk about this. Yeah.
But even with the sign off. If I understand Dan correctly, it's not been established or has been established that this indefinite metric actually is hyper-Kähler with respect to the complex complex structure.
So that
is true?
Okay. But whether there's a different metric, there's a different metric which is supposed to be
complex. And actually metric, not pseudo.
Well, maybe, I mean, maybe Greg is right, and maybe it's not the Griffiths Jacobian that we're supposed to use. Maybe we're supposed to use the Vey Jacobian.
What do you think, Joe? If you have a non-compact signal model with an indefinite metric,
well,
Well, I mean, what? No, it doesn't. For this issue, it doesn't matter because this part of the story does not change from dimension to dimension. Let me just erase this and say that the whole thing together is hypermultiples plus gravity. It's just that this has dimension. This has real dimension B3, right? And this has dimension. B3 minus 2 over, well, this has real dimension B3 minus 2, and this is the other 2. So somehow two of these belong with this, and the rest belongs here, but it's hard to separate them out. That was all I was trying to convey by that little remark.
If you're going for a quaternion metric, you wouldn't expect to follow with it.
Right. There are. I'd love to have a conversation about all this, but why don't I finish my lecture and then we can have the conversation. So of these parameters, as I say, the part having to do with the complex structure and also the variation of the whichever structure we put on this torus, right? I mean, we've got intermediate Jacobians of either Griffiths or Vey type. That'll be dependent on the complex structure that we're on. All of that stuff together will form one part of the moduli space, which can be studied, and these vector multiples form another part of the moduli space, which can be studied. So the philosophy I've been trying to advocate here is that we want to understand possible limits of this moduli space. And let me draw you a slightly more accurate representation of the projectivized Kähler cone. So the projectivized Kähler cone is going to have some shape like this, where it may actually have infinite tails running out. And aside from infinite tails, it will typically have certain kinds of walls of this sort. In fact, there's a lot of structure known, a lot of details about the structure of these Kähler cones for Calabi-Yau threefolds is known, consequence of the Mori program, studying birational geometry in dimension 3. Places where this projectivized Kähler cone is running out to infinity correspond to either K3 fibrations or T2 fibrations. On the Calabi-Yau threefold. And aside from that, we have some bounded cone which has certain walls, and of course the walls will meet in higher codimension faces. There can be, this is a locally polyhedral structure. With some small possible exception that's not known to occur. And is conjectured to not occur. But anyway, in all known examples, it has a locally polyhedral structure. And so one of the classes of limits that we need to understand are sort of the question, what happens when you go to these various walls that bound the projectivized Kähler cone? I want to try to study these two types of moduli separately. And it's not quite a product of the two types of moduli because there can be a little bit of monodromy on this structure, but it's almost a product. And so we can ask questions about varying the complex structure and these so-called, these three-form fields in this case. They become Ramon-Ramon fields in the 2A theory. Or we can ask about varying the metric to approach limiting values of the metric. So I want to address that question first. Yes, the Kähler cone can jump down. So there's this phenomenon which already occurs for K3 surfaces that the Kähler cone can essentially split in half at certain values, and you'll have a corresponding non-Hausdorff point in the moduli of complex structures. And if you use one branch in the complex structures, you'll end up in this half of the Kähler cone. And if you use the other branch, you'll end up in that half of the Kähler cone. So the overall Kähler cone plus this space is pretty well behaved because the points are separated. But if you try to study separately the complex structures, you'll run into jumping of Kähler cones at exactly such a moment. One reason for focusing on these is that there are some so-called non-renormalization theorems which predict that the vector moduli in this situation should not be corrected by quantum corrections, when the volume is large. Well, should not be corrected by quantum corrections. And that's because the gravity multiplet, which should be visible in any such quantum corrections, is sitting over in this part of the moduli, and the vector moduli doesn't really talk to that part of the moduli when you look at the low-energy action. It may be that there are other terms in the true effective action which mix together vector and hypermultiplets, but I don't think it's known. I mean, I don't think any such terms are known. So there's a belief that for this part of the analysis, the answers that are being obtained are exact. Okay, that's right. In 2A, the gravity appears in a different place. So we want to understand the possible limits of this moduli space, and they're going to correspond to the boundaries, the walls, of the Kähler cone. And at least at codimension one, I can make a rough classification of these walls into three types. Type A will be a case where a finite collection of curves contract to points. Type D, will be a case where a surface contracts to a curve. And type E will be a case where a surface contracts to a point. And if I work just in codimension one on the boundary, those are the only things that can happen. I can have mixtures of those things happening if I work in a higher codimension. Now, one of the things which we expect to occur is enhanced gauge symmetry by a mechanism very similar to what happened in the K3 case. So how will we get enhanced gauge symmetry? Well, that corresponds to D and its generalizations. We need a one-parameter family of curves set out according to some Dinkin diagram. So I'm drawing a case where the Dinkin diagram is A3. And the reason that it's a one-parameter family of curves that leads to enhanced gauge symmetry, well, this can be argued on several grounds. But essentially, you need some moduli in the parameter space in order for the quantization procedure that you would follow in studying the states in the quantum theory to include a vector multiplet, to include a gauge boson in the, I've erased my multiplets. But you only sort of get that from, not from the H0 of the space, which ends up contributing hypermultiplets always, but from an odd cohomology of the parameter space. So I've got to have the curves, the Riemann surfaces around which I want to wrap the M-theory membrane, I've got to have them moving in families of some size or another. And it turns out that enhanced gauge symmetry corresponds to these one-parameter families. Another argument that you could make is that, well, you could hope that if you took K3 cross a torus and studied the enhanced gauge symmetry mechanism there, and then thought about a supersymmetry-breaking deformation of the theory, that you would still see a quite similar geometry. And you can argue along those lines in a similar way here. So there is there are a couple of differences. We're no longer limited to the simply laced groups. And the way that non-simply laced groups arise is that there can be monodromy in the Dinkin diagrams. So I'm going to have a little trouble drawing this. But I can have this component kind of turn over. And then I can have this component join back around to that component. Well, I hope people can visualize what I've just done. So that here I've got my A3, but then by this point it's kind of gotten horizontal, and then by this point it's turned over. So that this one follows down to that one, and this one follows back up to this one. So monodromy on the Dinkin diagram leads to non-simply laced gauge groups. The other thing which can happen is that since I have a family now of Riemann surfaces moving on this threefold, just as happened in the case of elliptic vibrations that we were discussing earlier today, the curves in that family can degenerate at special points. So I might have family of P1s, which every once in a while turned into a pair of P1s, That's a sort of typical thing. And extra components in these surfaces, in these vibrations, correspond to additional charged matter in the gauge theory, additional charged hypermultiplet matter fields. And I should also mention that you can also get some matter from the quantization procedure, which will live in the adjoint representation, and in cases like this where there's monodromy, in another representation in addition to the adjoint representation. So there are several sources of possible charged hypermultiplets in this gauge theory. In the language of the theories with two supersymmetries that Dan was discussing this morning, or actually even the bosonic theories, here I've got some scalar fields in addition to my vector fields, and the appropriate multiplets are what we're discussing. So these guys will fill out the coordinates on some sigma model that you might want to build if you were in lower dimension, and these would correspond to the vector multiplets that I'm getting would correspond to the gauge theory. So the basic picture for enhanced gauge symmetry in these models is going to be the collapse of surfaces to curves. And if you've got a bunch of surfaces collapsing to a curve, along that curve, you end up with an A, D, or E type singularity. The monodromy will determine whether you've got the simply laced or non-simply laced groups. And the behavior of, well, both the genus of the parameter curve and also the singular fibers that you might get will determine the matter spectrum in the corresponding gauge theory. So this level of detail and complication wasn't possible with more supersymmetry. Here, where it's possible, it actually has this geometric realization. And in fact, there's this kind of slogan that was introduced by, is it first in your paper with Kummer, Katzenbacher, or is it earlier? Okay. Anyway, by Katzenbacher and maybe collaborators, called geometric engineering, in which you take the point of view that if there's some field theory phenomenon that you'd like to understand, you might be able to get your hands on it by writing down an appropriate geometry which would have the gauge group and matter content that you're interested in studying, and then by pursuing the study of the corresponding string theory or M theory using geometry, you might learn something about the field theory. I guess I have a slightly different philosophy, which is that I have not yet seen any field theory phenomena which cannot be at least locally modeled by a Calabi-Yau manifold. A sort of similar statement to the statement that you should be able to engineer things. So I think it's important to pursue the task of classifying everything that can happen to Calabi-Yau manifolds, because then we might learn everything that can happen to all field theories. Although I would also like to have an argument for why all field theory phenomena can be modeled locally by Calabi-Yau manifolds. N equal to eight supercharged field theories, right? We don't have as much experience with four supercharged field theories, but you know, quite a few things can be modeled with four supercharged field theories as well at this point. Okay, so this basic phenomenon D of a surface contracting to a curve is what we are learning from higher dimension is going to correspond to enhanced gauge symmetry. The situation A, where you have a finite collection of curves collapsing to points, well, This is a case in which you simply have the M-theory membrane wrapping around those curves. You get massless hypermultiplets when they shrink to zero size. And there's an interesting geometric phenomenon. Known as a flop, which is always possible in this situation of a finite collection of curves at the boundary of the Kähler cone, in which X is replaced by another Calabi-Yau manifold, X hat. These curves, these gamma I's, go over to some curves gamma I hat on X hat. It's true that X minus the union of the gamma I's is isomorphic to X hat minus the union of the gamma I hats. But the unusual thing which happens is that if you look at the induced map, so this is a rational map, if you look at the induced map on cohomology, and you pull back the class of gamma I hat, you find that it's minus gamma I. So which of these homology classes are represented by effective algebraic cycles is reversed. What that means is if you use this birational map to compare Kähler cones, is that the Kähler cones of X and X hat join along this wall where these curves shrunk to zero size. So here I've got Kähler cone of X. Here I've got the Kähler cone of X hat. And when you study the five-dimensional field theory associated with a single massless hypermultiplet, you discover exactly this phenomenon, that there's a little bend in the moduli space that happens at that point, but there are two sides, and you can continue to one side or the other in the parameter space, thereby sort of physically realizing the link up between these two spaces. No. It has to do with funny behaviors of CPT transformations in odd dimensions. And the mass term has a funny sign under CPT. I should have prepared this. I can't quite reproduce it. Right. And exactly.
Because the turn sign of the term is from the intersection numbers and those change. And that comes from the massless fermion.
There should be some fermion. Of course, it's a hypermultiplet, so it's got some fermions, yes. I mean, I have a scalar and whatever goes with it, a couple fermions, right? Okay, so that's kind of surprise number one at those particular boundaries, that you can have these two Kähler cones glued together along the boundary, where the Calabi-Yau manifold is singular along the boundary, but that singularity is corrected for in a process rather similar to what happened with enhanced gauge symmetry for K3s. It's corrected for by the presence of these additional hypermultiplets, in this case, massless hypermultiplets, which become massive on either side. I should have said while I was in case D that the boundary of the moduli space at this place where the gauge symmetry becomes enhanced is exactly what's expected. And the reason for that is that, if you're doing... If you have a field that looks like norm phi squared, then when it was a complex scalar, the norm phi squared field just went on down to the origin, and you didn't expect anything unusual to happen at the point of enhanced gauge symmetry. But if it's a real scalar, which is the case for the vector multiplet here, the real scalar in which norm phi squared, or really more generally some trace, goes in there. that being a real number will actually just have to be positive, and you will expect to find a moduli space ending, having some kind of boundary, just at the point of enhanced gauge symmetry. Another way of saying that in the case of SU2 is that what you is that you might have had an arbitrary value possible for that scalar, but then you're supposed to mod out by the Weyl group of SU2. And when you modded out that scalar by the Weyl group of SU2, you just got this half line because there was a fixed point there. So for things of type A, we're expecting to find a boundary. For things of type D, for things of type D, we're expecting to find a boundary. For things of type A, we've got this connection, this gluing between two moduli spaces. There's another possibility, and that is if there are homology relations among the, so I'm still in case A, and if there are homology relations among the gamma I's, which shrink to zero size, then it was proved some years ago by Bob Friedman, following some examples worked out by Herb Clemens. If I take the singular space, so I should call X bar here the singular space, then the then X bar has additional complex structure deformations, which in fact smooth out the singularity. So this is the Higgs-Coulomb branch phenomenon. I've got these, so I have this these additional complex structure deformations smoothing out the singularity, and so we get another Calabi-Yau manifold Y with a different topology than either X or X hat. I should have pointed out that X and X hat have the same Betti numbers, although their intersection ring changes between X and X hat. The Betti numbers are the same, but Y has even different Betti numbers, and having restricted to this locus along which these things attach, we then have another component of the overall moduli space that kind of emerges from this locus, in which the number of hypermultiplets that we're not focusing our attention on right now increases. So you decrease the number of vector multiplets, increase the number of hypermultiplets, and you have another component joining on. So not only do I get to merge two components of Calabi-Yau related by a flop, but if the singular Calabi-Yau also has a smoothing, I get to glue in the component that came from the smoothing. And all of these fit together in this process of I've got a, in field theory language, I've got some U1 gauge theory with some charged hypermultiplets, and there's a Higgs branch and a Coulomb branch for that theory, and those two branches are what's being described here as the moduli of the Calabi-Yau Y and the moduli of the Calabi-Yau's X and X hat.
Okay,
it's five-dimensional, yeah. I mean, it was originally worked out in four dimensions, but, you know, I just as soon do it in five today. Right, so if I include both, if I look at both vectors and hypermultiplets here, then I've got these two branches. I don't know how to draw it, because I've got these two real spaces meeting along a common boundary, and then over that, but then I've also got these complex structure deformations that I'm not drawing for you, but I get an extra complex structure deformation, but only emanating from that common boundary point. So that's where the additional component comes. So the set of Kähler structures on X bar and its complex deformations are labeled by points along this boundary. So this becomes the projectivized Kähler cone for Y. But there are additional complex structures which hadn't occurred before. And then there's E, where a surface contracts to a point, and those are harder to analyze. And given the hour, I think I'm not going to do that today, but I will do that tomorrow. But I will tell you that there was a reason for the letters in five dimensions. So if I work in five dimensions and I work in codimension one boundaries of the projectivized Kähler cone, then there are these A theories where I can have a certain number of n curves contracted to a point, n plus 1 curves contracted to a point. So I guess I call that AN. And then DN, I can have a single surface, but with N of these degenerate fibers. So I've got N line pairs in the surface, and that's contracted to a curve. And I can have an EN, which looks like a strong coupling limit. In a sense, I'll describe tomorrow, of DN minus 1. And these occur for any value of n, but this occurs only for n between 0 and 8. And there's also an E1 prime, which is the same combinatorics that we've seen for these E series in several other contexts. Here, what's actually happening is, well, I said a surface contracts to a point. It is a Delpeza surface contracting to a point. That's the only possibility. And the classification of Delpeza surfaces that I've mentioned a couple times before is related to this phenomenon. And I should also say that here there's also a D0 prime. There's a slight variant. Depending on when there are no singular fibers there, depending on whether you take P1 cross P1 or the one-point blow-up of P2 as your ruled surface, which is contracting to a curve. So there's this kind of ADE classification, n starting at 0 for A and D, which is a little unusual, and going on up to 8 for E, related to these codimension 1 boundaries of the projectivized Kähler cone. And I'll describe something about these strong coupling limits, and then what happens if you go to F theory in 6 dimensions and how those are related to interesting renormalization group fixed points in 6 dimensions tomorrow. I don't think I'm going to get to 4 supersymmetries. Sorry. Why am I calling it DN? Well, it turns out that there's a field theory model for all these things that has a global symmetry of a global symmetry group of SUN plus 1, SO 2N plus 8, and EN. And that's why I'm calling them A, B, and E. These, well, no. No. And that's because I said this wrong. I do. I do have 2 forms of SO0. Well, those are the algebras. I can't explain why I have 2 forms of SO0. But this is E2. I mean, one of them is, there's some Z2 that's either on or off. Right? You were just telling us about SO with a Z2 on or off. So. Okay, I'll stop there.